This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, we've been talking about BetterHelp for a long time on this podcast, but you don't have to take our word for it. If you want to hear how clients are responding, visit betterhelp.com/reviews. Now, it's basic statistics that the bigger the sample size, the more accurate the results. So with over 1.7 million reviews and hundreds more every day, that average rating of 4.9 out of 5 is serious evidence that you will be in very good hands. More than 6 million people worldwide have used BetterHelp, and the consistently positive feedback from real users is a sign of lasting quality. It's also easy to get started. Just answer a few questions, get matched with a therapist based on your needs, and switch therapists at any time if it's not the right fit. See the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit BetterHelp.com. That's better, H-E-L-P.com.
No one could stand between me and home. Not even the gods.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Cinephiles One Takes, where we might explore the themes and some of the history and possibly discuss the influence this film has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I am a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Rocha. I'm a writer, producer, host, and voiceover artist down here in San Diego, California. And I would like to say right off the bat, I apologize to people for the sound of my voice, but I'm still getting over COVID, and I'm here to talk about this movie. Very excited to talk about this movie with Steve.
Getting over COVID. That, John, that's so 2021. Come on, man.
Isn't it though? Leave it to Roka to always be behind the curve, man.
We got all sorts of new things to make us sick today. You should have eaten some lettuce or something. That's
yeah,
what
no shit.
Done.
No,
exactly. I prefer no shit, which is the path you've taken. But anyway, we are here for our second Cinephiles One Takes, and this is, of course, our opportunity to talk about a film in a more casual manner without going moment to moment with all the depth and detail and editing that we normally do. And I am super excited about the film we're going to talk about today because it is the film everyone is talking about, and that, of course, is Christopher Nolan's Odyssey.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we're dropping this as, I guess, Steve, we should say, we're dropping this as a regular episode to replace, for this week at least, part four of our talk on Oppenheimer. So I would say for me, because I got sick, apologies that we couldn't record part four, but we will be recording part four. This is more like a placeholder, so we want to thank everybody who is being patient with that. We want to thank our patrons who support us. And of course, if you listen to us and you listen to the ads, please make sure you use our codes to get some discounts off any of the goods and services that you get. So we are here to talk about the Odyssey, and this is just destroying the box office. Of course, we say this right now as Spider-Man Brand New Day has just exploded at the box office itself, Steven. This is really amazing to see how well this film is doing, how a 3,000-year-old story directed by one of the greatest filmmakers currently working today, who a lot of people believe belongs on the Mount Rushmore of current film directors of our time, has captured the public's imagination and desire. And also, Steve, really tickled the fancies of cinephiles like you and I by offering it at 70 millimeter IMAX and making it something where it's even a format junkie's joy to go and see it in multiple formats to enjoy a film like this. You know, it feels like David Lean, Lawrence of Arabia type of energy around this movie, man. It's crazy.
It's almost as if all the people saying that people aren't interested in movies anymore, and all the people who are just going, all we can do is put out the same versions of the same properties over and over again. It's almost as if that they made a mistake, you know? Like, people are interested in movies if you make really good movies, and if they're a filmmaker, and what I'll say, a filmmaker who is always surprising, who isn't actually just giving you exactly what you want, but is coming out there with their artistic interpretations, and people are here for it. And as someone who did get to see it in 70 millimeter IMAX, that is an experience. And I understand why you might drive a few hours to get that ticket at 6 in the morning or whatever you did, because that, I mean, our lives, I really think, you know, we've all gotten our worlds reduced to the size of our phones.
Yeah.
And we're starting to realize that experience can be kind of empty. And yeah. Go into a big theater with all sorts of people excited about having an experience together is kind of cool.
Yeah, I agree. And the fact that you can watch it in multiple different formats to appreciate the greatness of the movie, I think adds a uniqueness to it, a specialness to it that it like excites you as a lover of film. You know, you brought it up so well just a couple of minutes ago, Steve. There's been this narrative that the movie theater is dead. People don't want to go back. But we've seen statistics over the last 6 months of how much the numbers are increasing for people who want to go back to the theater. And I think it's amazing, you and I's old fogies, seeing that it's the young people who are bringing back movie theaters. It's the young people who are going to see it. Now we can argue about their behavior within the movie theaters. That's a separate conversation.
Kids these days.
Exactly. But it is young people who are going in large numbers to see movies over and over and over again, like they did when we were in the 80s. Yeah. We were young and going in to see movies over and over again. And I love that. But I also can't ignore the fact that there have been a lot of disappointing films this summer that were installments, that were part of franchises, that were sequels, that really didn't do well, or live action versions of animated films that do not do well. So I think you can't ignore the fact that the public, who had maybe set aside some money to go see these other films over and over again, are funneling that money to The Odyssey and what we see now to Spider-Man, because they are willing to pay to see something over and over again that is of high quality. They're willing to spend their money on it. And so that tells you that the movie theaters are not dead and that people still really very much cherish the movie-going experience, especially with a movie like this that is just absolutely top quality here, you know?
I have a new theory that I want to lay out for you, which is when a film movement is on the upswing, and people are doing a lot of that kind of film because they've become really popular, I think people's acceptance of the average installment within that movement are high. So if people are super excited about Marvel movies, they'll accept a Thor Dark World or an Iron Man 2, and sure. because it's on the upswing, because they're so excited that they're getting these kinds of movies.
Right.
But after they peak and they're on the downswing, people are no longer willing to put up with the average installment, which is kind of what we've seen a lot, where it's like, yes, why am I going to go out to see Supergirl, or why am I going to go out to see, you know, these middling kind of Marvel movies?
Yeah,
they're not going to. You need to give them something really, really good. You know, they're not going to just go to see everything that's in a property that you want them to see, because that's a they're not going to just see Grogu and Mando because people love Star Wars anymore. You need to give them something good.
I think there is the occasional film, like, in my opinion, the Jurassic World movies, that somehow kind of like will always make money because they scratch a certain itch for that fandom and for the general public. But I think the lessons to be learned over the last year is that just slapping a Marvel tag or a DC tag or a Star Wars tag or a Disney tag in terms of Moana, a live action, aren't going to lead to automatic box office dollars anymore, as you're just saying right now, Steve. You got to bring the quality. And as you're seeing Backrooms do so well, Obsession do so well, and these other films that are of quality to people in the public, this is the sign. Seems pretty basic to say, make a good movie and they'll come. But we've seen lately that there's been middling efforts that these studio executives, these creatives, these writers, these actors, these producers have tried to put across, thinking they could get away with it. And the public is making it very, very clear that you cannot get away with that anymore. You better bring your A game, because we are, as you said, distracted by smaller screens. There's a million other things that we can watch. YouTube is destroying television. There's a million other things we can watch that we don't have to go and sit in a theater and pay those high prices for refreshments or tickets, and parking even sometimes in certain cities, in order to see your movie. So you better bring it. And thank God Christopher Nolan did.
Well, let's get into this. I wanted to start way back in ancient Greece, John.
Okay, which is, let's go.
How did you first come to, or what is your experience with Greek mythology? Like, as a kid, did you read Greek mythology? Was this something you were into?
Yeah, I mean, but as a kid, yes. I wasn't like, oh, I understand what I am reading. No, it was more, because I think there were like children versions of the Odyssey and Ulysses. And of course, for me growing up, I grew up in the age of Ray Harryhausen on the television. So I saw Jason and the Argonauts. I saw Kirk Douglas as Ulysses or Odysseus. I can't remember. Yeah, I think it's Ulysses. So that's the stuff I grew up with, the fantastical nature of these stories. Medusa, like Clash of the Titans is 1981. So that's all my experience growing up. So it was more the angle of the fantastical nature of the creatures and the hero overcoming the obstacles. So that's what I remember as a kid growing up, reading the small short stories on this stuff that was condensed from the large text, and seeing those movies that were so much fun to enjoy and watch over and over again as a kid, you know?
So for me, it's very similar. Like for me, I think there were sort of four things. There was whatever science fiction I could get on TV, like Star Trek. There was comic books, and there was King Arthur, Arthurian legends, and Greek myths. And my mom was a huge King Arthur fan. She loved King Arthur stories. Mm. And I got, it's just what you described. It was here is the story of the Knights of the Round Table for kids. Right. You know, and I had the same thing for the Greek myths, and I read them over and over again. And just like you, I went to see those Ray Harryhausen movies, saw them on TV. I have a memory. I think it was for my birthday, and we went into the Mission District where my dad worked. We had ate dinner at a buffet where they weighed you when you went in to tell you how much you would be charged. And then we went to see the Golden Voyage of Sinbad. And I was like, this was one of the great birthday nights of my life. I probably was 9 years old or something like that.
Oh, my God. You could never get away with that now in 2020.
I swear to God.
You were weighed?
Look, take it with a few grain of salt, because this is a memory of me as a very little kid, but yes.
No, it sounds like a 70s thing to do for sure, to weigh people before they come into your restaurant. I just had never heard of that. That's amazing. And how do you trust that their scale is accurate? Oh, my God. That's amazing.
And really, today I go, there are a lot of really fucking skinny people who eat way more than me. You know, and so this is terribly unfair. That's Talk true. About a regressive tax system. I mean, but anyway, so I always loved these kinds of stories and read the Iliad and the Odyssey, you know, probably in high school or college. And then I read them again maybe 10 years ago. But since this is not a full episode of The Cinephiles, I have not reread The Odyssey for this.
Right.
But the thing is when we have our annual Cinephiles award show and we pick the best picture, there is a damn good chance I'm going to say right now that I will be reading The Odyssey next year. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think it's a very real possibility as well, Steve. And I think a lot of people feel this way. However, I will caution people. I'm going to say this publicly here, and then I'm going to tweet it out on Twitter probably in the next few days. I think Dune 3 is the only movie that will have the possibility of unseating The Odyssey as Best Picture next year. A, because it's the end of a trilogy, just like Return of the King was. B, because each of these movies has gotten consistently amazing and better. The first movie making 400-something million, the second movie making 700-something million. I think this third film is bringing it all and will make over $1 billion, in my opinion, if it's good, of course. It's a big part of it. And I just think this is the only movie that has any chance of unseating The Odyssey, because The Odyssey feels like one battle after another felt last year. Just inevitable, as Thanos might say. And so I absolutely agree with you. I think unless Dune 3 finds a way to unseat this thing, I think it's absolutely The Odyssey, because it's captured the pop culture as well as the film nerd's obsession. And that usually is the winning combo for a best picture when it comes to an epic like this, you know?
I agree almost 100%. I agree 93%. And in particular, there is a certain kind of movie that I always feel like, well, that's the kind of movie that should win best picture.
Yes.
You know? Yes. And there are other movies which are amazing movies that have won best picture that are not that kind of movie. The only dark horse, honestly, in my mind, is my other favorite movie of the year so far, which is Project Hail Mary. Mm-hmm. And here's what I'll say that's different about the two, and then we'll get into The Odyssey, is I think The Odyssey is a great film, and I'm going to have to see it. I've seen it once. I'm going to have to see it several times to really reckon with it.
Yeah.
I love Project Hail Mary top to bottom. Right. I love that. And those are two totally different experiences. You know what I mean? Like seeing a movie that I just love that movie and seeing a movie where you go, fuck, what am I doing with that? You know,
right,
that's different.
Right. But that's usually the one that wins Best Picture. Is what am I going to do with that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, and the thing you said that I think is so important is it got people out to the theaters and they got film people out, like the lovers of film to come out and see The Odyssey. And of course, you know, this is directed by Christopher Nolan, who we've been exploring for months now. So obviously one of the, as you said, one of the great directors working today, produced by Emma Thomas. And really one of the things you see with Christopher Nolan is he likes to work with the same people. Same cinematographer, composer, and editor as Oppenheimer, all sorts of cast members that are popped up from Oppenheimer and from other Christopher Nolan films. It is he is bringing the old team back to what it sounds like, from everything I've heard, is one of the hardest, most difficult, arduous productions ever, you know?
Yeah, and I think there's something that inspires actors in a situation like this to want to work with him. And I don't mean just the track record. I think it's also the challenge, right? I mean, because they're shooting on, as we should say this, I guess, the entire thing was shot on IMAX cameras, which I think is the first epic of this size to ever be shot completely on IMAX cameras. And I'm sure, Steve, you could go into this a little bit more as the technical side of things, but it's like, it can only run for like, what, two or three minutes?
I think so. You got to get 3 minutes.
You got to get your take right. And you don't want to waste film because it's a very expensive camera. And so Tom Holland talked about this in interviews recently. Like, he was really nervous about coming onto the set of Christopher Nolan film and really being able to deliver, because he wanted to get it right on the first or second or third take, like get these things right. And so there is a pressure on an actor and a challenge on the actor to do this research, to really get into the energy of the character, and also interpreting in a way that honors the text, but also modernizes it a bit, which was the approach here, and delivering a great performance. And I think across the board, I do think Tom is the shakiest of everybody, but he gets better as the film goes along. I think across the board, everybody brought it in such incredibly interesting and fascinating ways. And I think because they were challenged by the conditions, challenged by the situation, and just challenged overall by being as a creative to deliver what they needed to deliver and be worthy of being in a Christopher Nolan film. And I think those are amazing things.
Hi, Cinephiles fans. This is Steve, taking a moment to talk about our newest sponsor, Omaha Steaks. Now, everyone who listens to the show knows I love to cook. And frankly, there is nothing I cook better than steak. I've done au poivre, grilled, broiled, reverse sear, and even gone French style, basting the steak in the pan with butter, garlic, and thyme. But the truth is, a great steak isn't really about technique. It's about the simple pleasure of enjoying an amazing piece of meat. And if your meat sucks, well, so will your final product. That's why I was so happy to get Omaha Steaks as a sponsor on The Cinephiles. Since 1917, they've made it their mission to understand what makes a great steak. Now, personally, my favorite cut is a ribeye, but my 15-year-old is turned off by all that beautiful marbling. He prefers the far fancier filet, which means he's in luck, because Omaha filets are rated USDA certified tender. Now, very few companies receive that rating because it's difficult, costly, and time-consuming, but that's the kind of quality you can depend upon with Omaha Steaks. Now, you might not know where your local grocery store sources its meat or how they prepare it, but you can be absolutely certain that the butchers at Omaha have not only hand-selected and carved your steak, but they also dry-age their meat, making it more tender and flavorful. Every steak is then vacuum-sealed and flash-frozen to lock in that perfect flavor. I'm also super excited about their ground beef, chicken, and on my next shipment, I'm definitely going to check out their seafood selection. So try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99, plus get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. I just listened to a book called Inside the Box, and I don't have the author in front of me, but the basic idea is people think that in order to be creative, I need a lot of freedom. And in fact, there's, and he gives all these examples of these incredible like technology companies that had tons of money and huge ambitions and basically let all of their people like work on whatever you feel like. And so there are all these brilliant people working on all these things. And, but for some reason they never came out with a product, you know? And that's, and the thing is that there's something about limitations that Nolan understands of like, if I only have 3 minutes to shoot and there's all this pressure, everybody's going to come prepared.
Yeah.
Now, there are also places where it was great that there was lots of freedom and time to explore whatever they did, and other directors work that way. Just to your point about the technical thing with those IMAX cameras, it's really nuts what they had to invent because the cameras are huge, they're heavy, and they're super loud. And so normally you would just never record dialogue with them because the sound is bad. So they go, well, we need to solve that problem. So they build a giant Zeppelin, which is basically a huge case to put around the camera to muffle the sound. So now you can shoot dialogue. The problem is now it's so big that there's no way that the person, like if you and I are shooting us talking to each other and the camera's aiming at you, you can't see me because the IMAX camera's like 5 feet wide. Mm. And so then what they had to do was they invented a mirror system where I'm standing behind the IMAX camera looking at a mirror. That mirror is aimed at a different mirror that's aimed at another mirror that's aimed at you. So you can see my face in a mirror, even though I'm standing behind the camera.
That's insane. That's just insane.
It's insane. Yeah. And yet, and from what I heard from the, you know, the actors talking, like worked pretty good. You know, you felt like you were talking to that person. It's just, and Nolan's desire to do real physical things over and over again.
Yeah.
Well, this is, let me ask you this question. Can you sum up, what is your overall reaction to The Odyssey? I know you've seen it a few times. What's the overall feeling this movie gives you?
Awe, just utter awe. Because they don't make films like this anymore, bro. They don't. And to, and for you and I, who, you know, one of the really big reasons we started this podcast is our love of films, but also epic films and their ability to transport us into different places and speak to us on so many different levels and speak to us as we get older with different messages. And so seeing this movie, every time I come out of the theater, I'm just struck with this feeling of awe. Like, what an incredible interpretation of this story. Screw Emily Wilson. What an incredible interpretation of this story and making it accessible to me in a way that I've never felt about this story. And I've read the book. I've watched the previous movies. There was just something I really felt moved by in a way that I hadn't felt before. A friend of mine from back in college, Matt Burke, he texted me about this movie. He always texts me about the big movies, right? Matt is great. I love that. Never hear from him in between, but every once in a while, there's a big movie. He always texts me, Roka, what'd you think of this? I want to talk to you about it. Okay. He's a massive mythology person. Like, he worships at the altar of mythology. It has worked on him since he was like a young teenager. These stories. Well, I don't have that, right? I have that with Shakespeare. I don't have that with Greek mythology. And so I was like amazed at what he had said about what he felt watching the movie and how the movie had moved him. And so I, to me, was like, wow, it's amazing that he is getting what he's getting from this movie as a lover of mythology. And I'm getting it for the first time, what he has felt numerous times reading the book and seeing the different and reading the different interpretations of it. So for me, it was fascinating that for the first time ever, I connected with these characters. I felt their pain. I felt their joy. I felt the conflict of like, did I really want to go home? Did I not want to go home? Why did I leave? Am I worthy of going home? I felt the conflict with Helen of Troy. And because like, if you watch the movie Troy, I feel none of that when I watched that movie, but I felt it here. And I felt the anger and frustration of a male-dominated society, what it does to a woman of beauty. I felt what it's like for him, for Odysseus, to struggle with the idea of wanting to go home and the guilt of his mistake with the Cyclops affecting all of his men. So the weight of leadership. And then also seeing Tom Holland's character dealing with having to fight off these suitors who are trying to take his kingdom from him and marry his mom. And then Anne Hathaway's experience throughout the whole movie in a way that I had not experienced in the book. And what she is fighting off, what she is struggling with, how she has been. I mean, that moment when she says, I have been, who has been leading? I've been leading this thing for 20 years. And so there's something, wow, I hadn't even seen it that way. You know, so there were so many great new approaches to the text that for me really affected me and moved me. And I know some people may have issues with the interpretation. I could give a shit. I was involved. I was transfixed. And I think the film at the end, as I said, just awes me every time that it was able to do it. Plus all the fantastical scenes that we get just really brought it back in a way that was very grounded as opposed to like Clash of the Titans type of approach to it, which I really liked.
For me, there was like one word that I felt when I walked out of that movie theater, and that was visceral. It is one of the most visceral film going experiences I've ever had. And what's so interesting, because like I said, I reread The Iliad and the Odyssey probably about 10 years ago. And the reaction I had reading it was there's so much ambiguity in those books. There's so much like unfinishedness. You know, it's very early literature, and and Homer, if there ever was such a person, isn't going to tell you what to think about this. He's not going to tell you how to feel about this. It is this is what it is. And the thing that occurred to me, and so when I hear people, something I should say right up front, actually, let me pause just for a moment before I go to this, which is that there has been obviously a controversy around Odyssey that started building months before it came out. As people who have listened to the show for a while know that I'm generally the person to say, hey, let's listen to both sides and everybody has a point and let's, you know, moderate this and what can we learn from them? And that is not me for this thing. This has really pissed me off. I don't know why this is the one that has gotten to me. So you had said that, you know, there are people who feel that this is not the correct interpretation. And that to me is like, there isn't a correct interpretation. There are interpretations. And when I go to see a film, if I go to see a production of Romeo and Juliet, or I go to see a production, there's The New Death of the Salesman on Broadway, which I've heard is amazing. Mm. It's going to be different from the other productions of that I've seen, and it's going to be different from my expectations. The question is not whether a film fulfills my expectations. Did it work? Did it move me? And one of the things that moved me that you really just made me feel as well in your description is that it's a very lonely movie.
Mm-hmm.
There really isn't companionship until the very end when Odysseus finally reunites with Penelope. Everybody is very much alone. It's not like Odysseus. He has, you know, the members of the crew that he's close to-ish, but he's alone. Telemachus is alone. Penelope is very, very alone. Mm-hmm. It is a lonely movie. And like I said, a visceral movie to me, you know?
Yeah. It's a great point you bring up. Yeah, for sure. I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right. Yeah, Odysseus, even with all this crew, even you could argue Himesh Patel's character is probably the closest to Odysseus, but they always have this kind of distance from him.
Yeah.
And Odysseus, because they're either looking at him with either blame or get us out of this situation.
Yeah.
There isn't like, how are you? How are things? How are you feeling? Where are you at? There's no kind of conversations that come close to that consistently where you feel the pain of him losing his men because these were his legitimate friends. It's more a matter of the context of him as a leader screwing over his men by what he does with his arrogance with the Cyclops, and then trying to save his men from Circe later on because that's his way of showing affection for his men and making up to his men, but then also needing to sacrifice six of his men without telling his men in the Scylla and the Corinthus scene. So there is always this distance and they serve a purpose for where he's going. But it's about Odysseus. It's not about the rest of his men. And you're right. It's about Penelope. It's about Telemachus. It's their journeys and what they're experiencing. And even to a lesser extent, Leguizamo's character, who is incredible in the movie and I hope gets nominated, what he's going through here as one of the only people left that we know of, that we see, who still very much believes in Odysseus and believes he's going to come back and holds out hope that he'll come back. And of course, you talk about companionship. The dog is there, so we understand that there was a companionship before he went out on this journey, just like he had with Penelope, a marriage there. But they are both, even the dog is alone to a degree because he's missing his master until his master shows up, and then he promptly dies because he had waited so long for him. So, yeah, you're right. For a film that is about It's a film that is absolutely a commentary on journeys and experiences and coming back home, but also how sometimes this world can be a lonely world when you're going on your journey. And isn't that what a lot of people have been experiencing since COVID? This kind of loneliness, this disattachment, this sense of like not feeling connected to the whole. There has been a lot of people who've experienced that since COVID. So it may, on a very, very subconscious level, connect to people on that level as well, you know?
I want to go back to what you said about the relationship with Himesh Patel, because I think it's so interesting. And Nolan handles it with such a deft touch, because there's never a scene where they discuss their relationship.
No.
There's never a scene. There's no friendship scene. There's eye contact moments between them where you see some that there's something there. But I think it's very much what you said. It's like, A, Odysseus is a king. So he is not one of those men. B, he is a genius, and they know that he's a genius, and there's no question, like with the Cyclops and all sorts of other times, that he gets them through.
Yeah.
And they are continually, not continually on the verge of mutiny, but several times on the verge of mutiny because of how he treats them, because of his arrogance, because of his pride. And it's like, would he have gotten through Scylla and Charybdis without lying to his men, and because he knew that some of them were going to have to die,
or right.
should he have told them? And coming from our democratic free speech information era-ish at this point in our world, but coming from this world, it's like, well, of course you have to inform the men of what's going on. But it's very similar to the Elliot Page character of Senna, who he also has lied to, has sent to his death.
Yeah.
And that has to, I mean, it's funny. This is why this is a Cinephiles one take rather than our normal deep dive, because we're jumping around. But this idea of Odysseus as a person who is willing to sacrifice other people in order to win and willing to violate, you know, something that will come up a lot in the film is the law of Zeus in order to win. And what is the cost of that? And again, I don't think Nolan leaves us with any easy answers to these questions, you know?
Yeah, no, I think his overall message is about, you know, I think it is a commentary on not being suspicious of your neighbor, not being because of the color of your skin or where they come from or who they are. Zeus's law, right? Honoring Zeus's law. And yes, will that sometimes lead to negative situations? Yes. You know why? Because human beings are flawed. And that may happen, but that doesn't mean we have to change our nature and become this solitary provincial. What do they call that when you just want it to be just one nation and no one else?
Isolationist.
Isolationist. We don't have to become isolationists simply because when we open our doors, some negative stuff happens. Some negative stuff happens if you become isolationist as well. There is no easy answer, but we are better when we are more connected and more and understand the importance of that, which is what I think the film overall, why it harps on Zeus's law, because that is Nolan's commentary on what he has seen happening in the world over the last few years, this idea of othering everyone and not finding connection, but finding reasons to separate rather than reasons to unite. And I think this coming out, like right around the same time as the World Cup, where so many people who came to the United States saw that there was saw that the United States wasn't as bad as some of their media had told them in their respective countries. And people that were United States citizens were meeting people from other cultures and seeing that there was more to connect them than divide them. And I think that's the truth of it. Yes, there are issues that come up when you open doors. I understand that for sure. But we are always better as a people, as a populace, as a world, when we can connect with each other and find the things that we are have in common, instead of harping and elevating the things that we do not have in common or that divide us. And so I think that's what Nolan is making a commentary on throughout the whole movie. And I think that's an important message, you know, in our time right now.
100% agree. And it's, you know, there is a clear line between Zeus's law of welcoming the stranger and the golden rule of do unto others and the Sermon on the Mount. And much of the New Testament of the words of Jesus about welcoming the stranger and compassion and all of those things. And it is funny to me that these would be controversial. And I also think that, and this also brings up one of the other points, which is that, again, this idea of how do we interpret? Well, a lot of the ideas at each generation, in each era, when people have looked at the Iliad and the Odyssey and other classics, they have interpreted them based on that era. So as we moved into the Christian period and people went back during the Renaissance to discover these old texts, they interpreted them in Christian ways. They added ideas of sin and things like that. And at each era, they became, and then, like, just as we described, like, our introduction to the stories of Greek myths were as grand adventure tales from Ray Harryhausen, where we're fighting the Cyclops and fighting skeletons and things like that. Is that so? That at that point, it was elevating the adventure part of the story.
Yeah.
That's what we do with classic texts, is that we interpret them in different ways. And I, you know, since the character came up of Cinna, played by Elliot Page, this is one of the controversies. I think this was brilliant casting. Mm-hmm. I really do. I loved the performance. Yeah. And I think Nolan had really good reasons for doing this casting in this way. But I wouldn't have known those reasons until after I saw the film.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked the way it was done. He works with the people he has worked with before, right? When it was, when Elliot was a woman, they did a great work on Inception. And so now that he transitioned and he is a man now, like, using him in this role was so well done, and he's such a good actor. And that scene when he comes back to talk to him in the underworld in Hades was devastating, utterly devastating. And him saying to Odysseus, look what you did to me, you lied to me. So this idea of masks, this idea of deception, this idea of lying, right? There is also that running commentary, as you said, about the six soldiers he sacrificed. Sinon serves that purpose to highlight it, which I think is so important. Because for me, as I said, I've read it, watched the movies, whatever. It wasn't like an ingrained text for me. So a lot of this stuff, as the movie went along, I was discovering all over again. And so having that Cinna scene where she's, where he's making very clear what's gone on here, I was just transfixed by it, you know? And so I was like, oh, this is amazing. I hadn't even thought of this way. And now I have to look at Odysseus from a different angle, from a different perspective, because he's a troubling protagonist. And so I like that they used it that way. And the whole underworld scene, I mean, just, first of all, James Remar, who we just finished his scene, I think, with him as the Secretary of Defense, having him be the guy that comes out of the, spirit there in the underworld is amazing. Drinking the blood and everything, or whatever it was, like, that was amazing. He did such a great job with that because his voice is so amazing. But then the Agamemnon scene where he's telling him how to go home, how not to walk through the front door, and we see the lessons that Agamemnon serves, which is the idea of masculinity, overt masculinity, sacrificing your old child for something like the winds, the madness of it all, and what that can lead to. You know, someone said to me, or someone tweeted out, he had such aura. Agamemnon had such aura. And I said, yeah, he had so much aura right up until the point where Clytemnestra stabbed him to death in his fucking bed. How much aura is that? So it's that commentary on that level of that type of masculinity as well, that sacrifices everything else for their own self-aggrandizement. And so him saying to Odysseus, don't walk through the doors like you're some conquering champion. Assess the situation. Be more aware of things. Understand how people might be seeing you because of the things you did. And so there's just so much from that underworld scene. And Sinon is the one that kind of opens the door to all of that. And I love it, you know?
So many thoughts. So the first one, just on Sinon, I think what's so great about the casting is that you cast people for who they are. And what they bring, you cast them for what they bring physically, what they bring emotionally, what their face brings, what our relationship with them as characters. And the thing is, the Trojan War is a story of all these big, masculine, powerful people, Achilles and Hector and Odysseus and all these kind of people. And that is how we frame what heroism is. Yeah. And by casting Elliot Page, who's transmasculine, who doesn't come across like those things, and then to have Odysseus sacrifice that person. And that person having a backstory where they were pressured and essentially sacrificed and deceived by someone else. So yeah. that Odysseus becomes now paired essentially with Antonius, the Robert Pattinson character.
Yeah.
You know, like now we have this complex web of things. And that's part of why casting Elliot Page was so brilliant, in my yeah. opinion. Because if it had been, you know, some big muscle-bound person that we picture in the Trojan War, our experience of that would be different. Now, the yeah. Agamemnon thing. Now, first of all, my understanding is the death of Agamemnon is treated very much like it is in Aeschylus's Clytemnestra, I believe, is that he's kind of pulling from that. And I think that says, first of all, just the armor of Agamemnon, the physical presence, it was like a Batman suit. You know
amazing.
What I mean? Like,
yeah, I love
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Every time he walked on. And so it continued, the movie continually told us visually, yeah. this is the great man. This is a great, he is
right.
and I don't mean great in terms of good. I mean, this man is more than any other person. He is the great Agamemnon.
Right.
And then he goes home believing himself the great man, letting all sorts of people die, having this whole war for ridiculous reasons, destroying yeah. this city, you know, the sacrifice that, you know, as you said, with the kid. And then he comes home thinking, hey, here I am. Guess right. what, great man? You're just a man, you know,
yeah.
like
yeah.
that's what, you know, it said, you are human. And now, and of course it parallels Odysseus is going back to his home. And what will he find having left it for 20 years? You know?
Right. Right. And I also think, speaking of parallels, Steve, I wonder if you, what you thought is like, watching it the second time, I found that, what's Tom Holland's character's name?
Telemachus.
I found Telemachus's journey to mirror Odysseus's journey. Mm. Like, it's not him going, I mean, he does go away from his home. He does lie to his mom to sneak out. Like, he is a young man trying to find his place in the world. And young men sometimes will make stupid decisions or dangerous decisions, will go to try to find the information they want to find. So he is on his own odyssey, Telemachus is, to find his strength, to find his power, because he feels lesser than to his dad. He feels and is mocked and ridiculed and physically, you know, manhandled by the suitors, Robert Pattinson's character and Corey Hawkins' character. They all ridicule him. They don't see him as any real barrier or obstacle to getting to his mom. So Telemachus, in a way, is on his own odyssey of discovery. Who am I? Can I lead? Should I be a king, right? Whereas Odysseus's odyssey is about, am I worthy to be a king by the end of this journey? I was a king. Am I still worthy to be the king by the time I end this journey? So it's a fascinating parallel to watch. Now, I think Telemachus experiences danger that is comparable to Odysseus's danger for his journey. I'm not saying they're comparable in terms of like Cyclops, but him walking into John Bernthal's kingdom to essentially have a conversation with a guy who's clearly fucking unstable and who mauled his beautiful wife's face, half of her face, as a way of saying, you know, like, you'll never be pretty again. You'll never start another war again. That kind of, you're mine now. I've marked you. There's a danger in that. You know, it's not a Cyclops eating heads off your soldiers, but there is a fucking danger in that. So there's things that he experiences that in the end, he has to also kind of figure out, is he king by the end? Should he be king? Is he strong enough to be king? So I like that there was that element to the film as well as a parallel to Odysseus's journey, for sure. You know,
I have strange feelings about Tom Holland as Telemachus. So, and I'm going to say it in exactly how I feel it, which is
okay.
I do think he's the weakest in the film.
Yes.
And he's particularly the weakest in the film in the first half of the film and gets stronger later on.
Right.
And this is where I go, Telemachus, the character of Telemachus in the book, it's not that cool, you know?
Right.
And so
right.
part of it is because what's weird about the story, because I keep wanting it to be, you are the son of the great king and you will emerge as your own great king. This is yeah. a coming of age. And in the end, you will be Luke Skywalker and be at Odysseus's level. That is not what this story is. Telemachus yeah. will never be Odysseus. He right. is the son of a great man who will never be great, which frankly, most of the time, people who are the son of the great person or the daughter of the great person can't match what their parents did. Right. You know, that's not possible. And so I think it's in this weird way, it is kind of correct to the text that Tom Holland is a little bit weak and particularly weak in the first half of the film, you know? So I'm going to have to really see it again to sort of figure out exactly how I feel about it. I kept wanting there to be more, like when we're in the final battle, which I think goes on too long and I have problems with the final fight scene, but I really wanted Tom Holland, Telemachus, to have more of a moment. Like, come on. Like, dad was downstairs fighting like 50 people forever. Yeah. And he's just struggling with this one dude. And I'm like, dad needs help, man. You should swing down and jump, you know, but it just, that's why it just keeps going. It goes beyond credulity to me that even the best fighter at this point would be able to fight all these guys. Like it just goes on weight. And what I didn't like about that, and it's not the choreography isn't good. It's pretty good, but it goes on the earlier fight scene where there's the ambush that he stops. That fight scene I actually think is really good. But the long one, it becomes just about, you know, Odysseus as Bruce Lee, which is not actually what I want him to be. You know what I mean? Like there's a certain point where I go, come on, at the end, you know?
Yeah, but I hear you. I hear you. I didn't bump on it. I liked it. It does feel a little John Wick-esque, right? Where he's just constantly overcoming these guys and whatever new, he grabs their swords and uses it on them and all this kind of stuff. But I have to say, I thought the film earned it for what it was, but I totally take your criticism and think it's a valid one to make for sure. But I enjoyed it for what it was and where it took us to. And you know what? Seeing Damon do a little Jason Bourne every once in a while. Yeah. It's nice to see that. I saw someone post something going, oh my God, it's Jason Bourne, which I thought was hilarious. But like,
well, and he did lose his memory earlier in the story. So.
exactly. So, but I hear you on Telemachus, but I wonder if like, if they had made this hero moment, is that a violation of the text? Cause I don't think that's in the text. So, you know, maybe Nolan felt that was a place he couldn't fully go to with this whole thing, you know? So, but I take your point. I mean, I think he is the weakest character in the movie, and not just because the character itself isn't that strong in the original text. It's because Tom, I don't think, fully stepped up to the plate the whole time during the movie. And I think you're right. In the beginning, it's a little shaky. He gets stronger as the film goes along, for sure.
Just to bring up our next controversy, you mentioned Helen of Troy, and this is where it all started. The casting of Lupita Nyong'o for Helen of Troy. And first of all, A, this is a myth, folks. Second of all,
yes,
Helen was birthed out of an egg. She's the child of Zeus. Third, this is one of the big things of this era is this is the era of early sail in the Mediterranean. And people traveled. Greece is not that far from Northern Africa. Like, this is just, you know, people were traveling all the time. It's not like you didn't see people that looked different. Yeah. And I go back to, she was born out of an egg. And what bothers me so much about this is what's happened is we have seen different interpretations of Greek myths and Roman stories and all this stuff for all of filmdom. And only now are people saying, hey, this isn't accurate to the text. And it's like what they're saying that they want is blonde-haired, blue-eyed people speaking with British accents, which isn't accurate to anything. Like if you go back to our two most recent ones are Troy, as you said, and Alexander. And both in Troy and Alexander, and to be real clear, there are fair-haired and fair-skinned people who lived in Greece and Macedonia, that they are, but the vast majority of people who live there have dark hair and darker skin, and yet, when they cast Colin Farrell as Alexander the Great, they dyed the dark-haired guy's hair blonde, and when they cast Brad Pitt as Achilles, they dyed his hair blonde, and then everybody speaks in these pseudo-Shakespearean accents, and everybody watches that and goes, fine, that's all fine. But when they don't speak in the pseudo-Shakespearean accents and we have people that look different, it's like, no way, you've broken the that's not how art works. Like, and I don't, and in particular, when you're interpreting mythologies, there should be a fair amount of latitude to cast it how you want. And again, all of the controversy happened before people saw the movie, you know?
Yeah, that was the most frustrating part of it all. And, you know, you and I as creatives and also as people who host a film, a show talking about film and loving film, it's about wait till the product comes out, then you can fully assess it. That's really the way it should be, because there are oodles and oodles of examples of people who said before a film came out, that's not the right person for this. People didn't think Heath Ledger was the right choice for the Joker, or Michael Keaton the right choice for the Batman, or any number of things. There are a million.
Hugh Jackman was wrong for Wolverine, John.
It wasn't even the first choice. Doug Ray Scott was the first choice. Yeah, and so like, there's all kinds of things when you look at the situation where it works out. But I think I will say this, for the small percentage of people who legitimately had an issue with this. By the way, the Prime Minister of Greece even came out and said, I love this movie. This is not an insult to Greeks. But for the small amount of people who felt this was an insult to them as a person who is Greek, I will say, okay, I understand that. If you legitimately feel that way, if racism is not at the core of your issue, then you have a legitimate issue and you are fair to speak or not. But a majority, I would argue 95 to 99% of the people who were harping on Lupita Nyong'o being Helen of Troy was A, because she was black, or B, because they didn't find her attractive. And all of that is utterly asinine, because if it is absolutely from a race place, go fuck yourself. That's my honest opinion on this whole thing, because beauty is relative and subjective. And I would argue Lupita Nyong'o is quite attractive for a lot of people. And so for the people who had an issue with it and built like YouTube channels off of it or YouTube videos off of it, I think these are disgusting people. And 9.9 times out of 10 don't hold a candle in terms of attractiveness to Lupita Nyong'o. And so for me, I think this is where the frustrating part is. You're allowed to not find her attractive, of course. I mean, I don't find Jennifer Lopez attractive. A lot of people feel she's attractive. There's nothing wrong with that. But to say that she shouldn't be in the role because you personally find her ugly, I think is abhorrent. You have to watch and see what she does with the role and what the role was in the movie. And I think it also spoke to a lot of people who had never read the text and know that Helen is not a big part of the Odyssey. So there's another element of that, that's an ignorance coming through with all of this, along with the ignorance of racism. There is an ignorance of the text and her actual role in the movie, which is why they all looked like utter idiots when the film came out and was a massive success. And people ridiculed them up and down for them clutching their pearls over a character that was in the film for a maximum of 5 minutes and another character in Elliot Page's character that's in the film for a maximum of 3 minutes. They looked foolish, you know? And so I think in the way, I'm glad this happened, because now here is an example of how little power that this section of the internet, this loud section of YouTube, actually has when a film comes out and is excellent. And it shows that a majority of people are open to artistic interpretations of these classic characters, as long as you deliver it within the context of a great film or a good film, people won't have issues with it. Because a majority of people, I think, are good. It's just these loud, angry, racist, transphobic people who sullied the waters. But in the end, I think it worked out, because we got to smash them over and over again for their inherently inauthentic points of views on this movie. You know.
Well, first of all, I'm a little upset that you wanted us to lose J-Lo's support on Patreon. I think you're a beautiful woman. I appreciate you being at the top tier level, and we hope that you stay listening to the show. What's so funny to me is the...
We'll do one of your films one of these days.
Yeah, someday.
Maybe on a one take. Yeah, yeah.
First of all, what's funny to me is that almost always when anybody tries to create a controversy, you drive more tickets to sell for that film.
Yes, true.
So they probably help the box office. What really bugs me is it's the wanting to enlist everybody in your culture war issue, even if you don't want to. Christopher Nolan is not a culture warrior. There's nothing about his films that says that. There are certainly have been films, particularly, in the post George Floyd era, where Hollywood was bending over backwards to give some voices who didn't have a lot of voice parts. And some of them didn't work out that well. Some of them, it really was, they were just trying to check a box, and checking a box is not a good way to make a movie. But that's not what this is. That's not what Christopher Nolan does. Christopher Nolan is a challenging filmmaker who's going to make Christopher Nolan films. He's not a soldier on any particular side of the culture war. And what it has, what it does is that this whole thing forces people to somehow take sides. Like you are either, if you support the Odyssey, then you obviously don't like America, or you don't like Western civilization, or you don't like this. And if, you know, and then they battle back and forth. And the idea that somehow spending hundreds of millions of dollars and years of your life making a piece of art that is based on one of the pillars of Western civilization is somehow an attack on Western civilization. I kind of want a definition of what you think Western civilization is, you know, like what exactly do you think it is? Because it's not a simple answer. All right.
Yeah.
So, so we'll move on. There will be other controversies maybe that come up later. Polyphemus, John the Cyclops. How do you feel about this sequence?
Well, listen, this is one of the stories that always stood out to me from the Odyssey, for this particular scene, because there's the conversation and the tricking, right? It's very similar to Gollum and Bilbo in The Hobbit, where he tricks him about the ring in his pocket and all. So the Cyclops gets tricked here in the actual story, the nobody stuff and all that. So I loved that in the original story. But I also loved what Nolan did with the Cyclops story here, because he made it fit within the context of the interpretation or adaptation that he was making of his version of the story. I like that he's this like just massive beast that is not too big where it becomes so fantastical, but it is absolutely overwhelming and scary to see him walk through this cave indiscriminately grabbing soldiers, eating their heads off, and then going to sleep. There's no conversation. There's no like, you violated my home. He's just doing it because it's just what he does. And it's not when something like that comes into his purview. And he also lets out his flock every day and brings them in every day. So there is a sense to this Cyclops that it is just this unknowable thing, an entity that is overwhelming. And you do have to trick in order to escape it. And I like that they did that. And I like at the end that Odysseus shoots that arrow in a moment of arrogance, which is what curses them for the rest of the movie. And so to me, there was this sense of like, why the fuck did you do that? Yeah, I was on your side all the way up until this moment in the movie when you hit that arrow. This thing is already damaged. It didn't kill because it hated you. You violated its space. You went into its home. And so for me, I was just like, why the fuck did you do that? So I like that as a challenge for me as a viewer, that I was looking at Odysseus in a different way from that moment on to the rest, to the end of the movie.
You just encapsulated, I think, perfectly like how a director comes to a certain choice, because in the original text, as you said, there's this bit where he says his name is Nobody and Polyphemus remembers that. And then on his way out, in his arrogance, he can't help saying, see you, I'm Odysseus. So now Poseidon knows his name. And I'm sure I can picture exactly how this goes down. Maybe there's a draft of the script where that dialogue is in the movie. And Nolan is thinking about this, as I said, visceral, overwhelmingly visual way he wants to tell this story. And he goes, if I put the nobody dialogue in here, it's going to lessen the impact of what I am doing visually. It's not going to work that well. So now he goes, well, then if I don't have that in, how does Poseidon find out about Odysseus? And how do we have that moment that you just described of where you feel critical of Odysseus? You were away free and then you had to say your name, you dumbass, you arrogant dumbass. Well, so what he does is he still created exactly that moment emotionally with him firing that arrow, but without putting in the dialogue that he felt would lessen the experience of the Cyclops sequence. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, and it mirrors the Agamemnon situation, right? Because him shooting that arrow at the Cyclops is his way. He's saying, well, he ate our men. He attacked our men, right? He violated, never mind that we violated his home by going into his home and we were going to steal his sheep and eat his sheep because we were hungry. We didn't ask him. We were just going to take it. But because he killed our men, I get to shoot him with an arrow, right? It's just like Agamemnon. Well, you stole hell and I'm going to start a whole war over this, right? It's just that kind of thing of this arrogance of this idea of, well, he violated my man code, therefore I must be allowed to do these things. But there's a consequence to all of that. And so I like, again, even in the situation, he's making a commentary, Nolan is, to a degree, on this kind of stuff that I think is great when you watch it. And you're right. Yeah, I think him having the conversation would have cheapened the feeling of the groundedness of these gods or these fantastical creatures that are in the movie. And even more so when we get to the tall, armored soldiers that are sweeping them aside like they're just like they are brooms sweeping aside pieces of lint. That was even more scary because I think the whole film is just a conversation about how life is tough and there are obstacles and challenges and things that can overwhelm you that you may not see coming. You've got to figure it out in order to survive and live and achieve the things you want to achieve. Welcome to the real world. And yes, these things may seem overwhelming or even fantastical in a way, and even more difficult to overcome, but you've got to overcome them if you want to accomplish something or strive to achieve something in this world. You know?
First of all, just going back to Polyphemus just for a moment, is that I didn't know going into the movie, but it's so obvious after I read the credits that Bill Irwin, of course, who's in Inception as the robots, plays Polyphemus, which is great. As far as the giants are concerned, I always remember there's a Cyclops and there's this lady that turns guys into pigs and there's other place where he gets never remember that there is a giants. And so as soon as they show up and they were goddamn terrifying.
They were terrifying, bro.
It really gives you, I think so often, because we're so used to Marvel movies where human beings get hit by something and go flying across the room and then they get up, which human beings don't, you know? The sense of their strength and their power and the helplessness of Odysseus and his crew was really, really scary.
That's a great point you bring up because I just watched Endgame again back to front the other night in my COVID stupor. And I love the film. It's probably my favorite Marvel movie, period. But an entire Avengers compound is dropped on Hawkeye. And he just gets God. It's like you have no superpowers. You're not a god. You don't have a special suit. You're just a dude with arrows. There is no way that whole building being dropped on you and you're just like getting up like you had a bad workout. You know, it's like ridiculous. So you're right.
There's a moment it popped up in something I was watching, and it was the Civil War where Tony Stark is fighting the Winter Soldier and he only has his hand armor.
Oh, yes.
And he's getting punched across the room. I'm like, Tony, you're just dead. It's just a dude. Like, that doesn't work.
Such a great point.
All right, we have to get to the most disturbing sequence for me, which is let's talk about Cersei, who is Samantha Morton. The great Holy scene. Crap.
This scene, bro. Wow, what a scene. What a scene. And you know what's great is when you see a scene, you go, this is amazing. Are other people going to get it? And you walk out of the theater and everybody is talking about that scene. And even people now are saying that she should get nominated for Best Supporting Actress for one scene. That tells you how powerful and well done that scene was. And Samantha Morton is an actress who's been around for a while. You know, she's one of the precogs. She's one of the main precogs in Minority Report. She's such an excellent actress. And she was great. And she said, if you guys have ever seen that Harvey Weinstein film, that is fantastic. I highly, highly recommend that. She has one scene in that movie as well as a former assistant who was abused by Harvey Weinstein and shows up years later to speak to the two investigative reporters, which is a scene in like, I think a cafe or a diner. It is devastating, her scene. And you feel the weight of what she experienced at his hands as a young assistant. And so she brings it, man. She's such a good actress. So getting a chance to be highlighted in a massive film like this, I hope leads to more opportunities for her because she's always had a very avant-garde instinct. You know, there's a little Tilda Swinton in her. Like she's very avant-garde instinct to choose certain roles and to bring her work to. But I think here she is excellent, just excellent in what she's scared and she's frightened. And so, and of course she's got her sister there. So she's clearly a very damaged person who is seeking or trapping companionship in a way, which you were bringing up an hour ago, the idea of companionship. For her, she wants to trap her companionship. And then there is residue anger towards men that she has. So instead of speaking to these guys or understanding these guys or getting to know these guys, she immediately assumes that these guys are here to take things from her. And by the way, you know, they did do that with the Cyclops. They were trying to do that with the Cyclops. So she's not 100% off base, but she just sees them in a certain way. and immediately plays to their worser instincts and then turns them into these pigs. And by the way, that's all practical effects. They have said this. It's not a lot of CGI or special effects. She was literally made contraptions where she's literally pulling these things out of their faces that makes it look like she is creating these animals out of their faces. It was amazing. And her, by the end, when Odysseus confronts her and beats her in a battle of wills, and she realizes, you know, how damaged she is by, because of the actions she's taken, how damaged she is in being all alone in this shack, the way she is, being insulating herself from the world out of fear. I think it's a phenomenal scene, more than just the special effects or whatever they did there. It's the commentary that they're making. Once again, grounding this god like Circe and seeing the very human things that she's experiencing there in that shack. You know, what about you?
It's the most, I mean, I use the word visceral. This is the most visceral scene in the movie. Special effects are absolutely astounding. I mean, and the fact that they're real, that this is physically happening in some way. And it's just the slop of the stew and the way the men are eating and all of the physical details that make you feel what's happening in that scene and her anger and the, and it's so funny. It always was the most memorable sequence in the book to me. And this is the most memorable sequence in the movie. And what's so great about it is it's not like she's the bad guy and she has trapped our innocent heroes. And it's not like we're the bad guys and she is a hero. It is that these are all really complicated. She does have reasons to be angry. She does have reasons to not trust these guys. And it is horrible to watch what happens to her. And man, when you see Matt Damon in the same position, even though I know the story, it's one of those things where I know he's going to get out. I know he's going to rescue his men. But when that food goes in front of him and he's hungry and I still was going, don't eat it. Don't eat that. Don't. Oh my God. Yeah. It was an incredible cinematic sequence for me.
Yeah. Yeah. She's so good.
I think the treatment of the sirens is one of the best ones I've seen. I love the way he did it.
Yeah. When I did my non-spoiler review with this, I said there were three scenes that stood out to me, and the Cyclops scene, the Circe scene, and this scene. And I should have added the underworld scene. So that was my mistake. But the siren scene for sure, dude, that affected me on so many levels, because it was brilliant, genius to leave the siren song to be whatever we think it is. Like, so simple and smart, but that's what a genius filmmaker can do. See the way to do it in a way that is simple, yet seems like it's phenomenally intelligent, because we all have our own siren song. And you don't even see like a close-up of the sirens. Just seeing them move on the rocks is enough fear. It brings enough fear into you looking at that. And then him tying himself, which is of course what happens in the book as well. But Matt Damon's nonverbal acting in that sequence, because everyone has wax in their ears, so like they turn the sound off for us as we're watching it, I think was the reason he's not, I would nominate him for an Oscar. Like that sequence is just to me, I said that sequence, I think I said this in another thing, that sequence mirrors the Quaalude sequence in Wolf of Wall Street. Like it is that, you know, that level of physical performance that he is doing tied to a post to show all the emotions that he is going through in that, and the horror and the pain and the sad and the utter break that happens within his soul hearing that. And then when he explains to Himesh Patel's character what he was experiencing specifically beat by beat, to me, that was devastating. Just to say that the thing, imagine listening to a song that makes you want the thing that you've always wanted, but you can't have it, and realizing that you already had it and you lost it in pursuit of the other thing that you thought you had. That is like fucking mind blowing. And just, it broke me in my mind with that, what he said there. And so I love that scene, bro. Just absolutely love that scene.
I do too. I think, and it's so, it's part of the choice is so, to me, so obvious, which is that you go, okay, I have to have the siren song. Is there any sounds I can make that can come out of a theater speaker that is going to be worth it? And the answer is no. There's literally nothing you can do. So better to not have anything. And that explanation, because not only does it apply, obviously it applies perfectly to Odysseus leaving Penelope and you know, what he might have lost to go off on the war. But every single human watching that movie can hear that explanation and go, yeah, I know exactly what that is in their own life, you know?
Yeah, exactly,
And I thought the way that we saw the sirens was exactly, it was, the, you saw there was something there, they were somewhat female-like, and that's all I get to know, you know?
That's all I want to know.
Then we have Calypso with Charlize Theron. Again, it's always sort of an odd part of the book, but I think this is where the movie started to feel, I started to think about PTSD, and I started to think about, you know, self-medicating, and I started to think about forgetting and all those things. And that's what a classic text can do, because anyone who is going to present a classic text, they're not going to present, I mean, I went to a very, my theater school at Cal, very, very academic. And so they frequently went, okay, let's actually try to do this Shakespeare play the way it was done in Elizabethan England. So, and that's sort of an academic experiment, but that's not real theater. In fact, there's one, I remember one of the things in, did you ever read a book called The Empty Space by Peter Brook?
Oh, of course, yes. For, the, for directing. This
This was assigned to everybody. Peter Brook, one of the great directors. And one of the chapters in the book is called The Deadly Theater. And what the Deadly Theater is that people will go to, let's say, Shakespeare, and these are the intellectual elite people who are going to the fine Shakespeare that's supposed to be good for them because this is what classy and culture does. And so they go and they watch this play and they're entirely bored throughout the whole thing, don't really get it, and walk out feeling satisfied because being bored in a Shakespeare play is like exercise. That's what you're supposed to do. That is the Deadly Theater. And to me, the idea of just perfectly encapsulating the classic version of what this was supposed to be, you know, thousands of years ago, is the Deadly Theater. Anyone who is trying to make art that is alive has to interpret it in a way that they think will play for a modern audience. And this moment of Calypso, of medicating yourself, not wanting to see your own reality, not wanting to look at your own past, not wanting to look at the really negative things of your past, is a very modern, he interpreted it for me in a way I related to in a very modern way.
Yeah, I think so too. But I do think this, it's, as you said, it's a weird part of the book. And I think for me, this is where the film felt a little long. And I
agree.
And kind of slowed down a little bit for me. And I didn't quite understand, like, why was she so obsessed with him? Why did she want to hide him out? And then, of course, she explains it later. And so, this is where me not being too familiar with the text made me like go like, what's happening here? What's up? But by the time it was over, I was like, oh, I get what's going on. He's got to confront the fact that he didn't actually want to go home. And so why? Why didn't we want to go home? What's been going on for him? So that was a nice like kind of twist for me once we got to that section of that section. And I enjoyed it in retrospect, thinking about it afterwards. And I mean, honestly, who the fuck wouldn't want to stay with Charlize for a lot? I mean, like, for God's sakes, she is so gorgeous. Jesus Christ.
Feed me those lotus blossoms, Therese.
I'm in.
I mean, the line that occurs to me is, you know, the opening of Apocalypse Now where he says, when we were in the jungle, all we could think about was going home. And when I was home, all I could think about was getting back to the jungle.
Yes.
You know?
That's a great line. Yeah.
Telemachus and Penelope have a major fight, and I think Anne Hathaway's great. I think it's what is, she is a complicated character. She, you know, cause you want her to like be nice to her son, but she's like kind of not, you know, and so powerful. And so it's, as you said at the very beginning of our conversation, I've been running Ithaca for 20 years, you know, and she's been running it. She's so alone behind that screen, you know, walled off from everybody while just this chaos is happening in her halls. It's, I think she's great.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not always the biggest Anne Hathaway fan as we've talked on the show at times and, you know, we did Devil Wears Prada. I thought she was good in that movie. I didn't think she was good in the sequel. I think she's very project dependent, what you're going to get from Anne Hathaway. Yeah. And I think here, she stepped up in a way that as she has not stepped up in anything else I've ever seen her in. Just what she was able to bring to the role was just so much power and weight and depth. And complexity, and I think brought a tenderness to it that is not in the text from what you're insinuating, Steve. Because again, I've read the text a couple of times. It's not so ingrained in me that I know everything about Penelope, but there are you can tell that she loves her son. You can tell that she cares for him, but she also has a line, you know, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to cross this line. I'm not going to, who do you think has been running things? Like, there is this woman pushing back against the male domination of the time in that particular situation. Like this idea that Telemachus thinks he can be overly familiar with her in a certain way while not understanding what she's been doing. You're overlooking what I've been doing, right? Even the way the battle of wills with Robert Pattinson's character when he finally gets through to talk to her as she's making the thing there and calling her out, saying, we know you what you've been doing. We know you've been unwinding this thing that you've been sewing every day. We understand what you're doing. We finally hit our limit with the bullshit of playing this game with you. And so I like that she's toe-to-toe with them constantly. And the scene with her and Odysseus when he finally returns, I think has so much weight and power with the flashback of them, of you see her love for him and wanting to stand by him and him going, you know what, you can find other people. And she's like, I don't want to fucking find other people, you dope. I love you and I'm going to love you and wait for you no matter what you tell me to do, right? And so it isn't until she finally just goes like, okay, we've hit the limit, that she's willing to entertain the idea of suitors. And I imagine she had another plan in place if Odysseus wasn't this beggar that ended up becoming who he was. So it's like, she just has so much command and power. And it's a role that I've never seen her play. And colors, levels as an actress that I've never seen her bring to the screen. And I thought that was great. Even in her Oscar-winning role in Les Miserables. I have never seen her do this kind of thing. And it's very much a woman's performance. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I see too. There's maturity. Well, and this is the thing Christopher Nolan got a good Catwoman out of her.
Yes.
She's good in Interstellar. And yes. I think she's really good in this. So part of it is having the director that sees things in you that they can bring out, you know. Like, I agree. It's interesting. The one of the things that in my memory of the book, like it's been a little while, is ambiguous in the book. And I still find a little ambiguous in the film of like, what does Penelope think? Like, why, you know, what does she think of this beggar guy? Is there something that recognizes him or not? And it's always a little bit like, I don't know, you know, like it seems like it's not, but then maybe it is. And I think that actually plays to it really, really well. One other thing I think, and I believe this is not in the book and added for the movie, is the Sinon Antonius thing the betrayal. And man, that comeuppance of the Robert Pattinson character, fantastic.
Yeah. Listen, he plays a great chicken shit heel. That's the wrestling term for a chicken shit heel.
He's
so great. Yeah. And he did this in The King, the Henry V. Film that's on Netflix with Timothy Chalamet as Henry V and Joel Edgerton as Falstaff. If you guys haven't seen that movie, it's so good. And he plays the Dauphin, Robert Pattinson does, as the chicken shit villain. And he's so good here. Just the little things he does with his face, because he's such an interesting angular face. The way he's able to say certain lines, certain words that are just interesting in the way he does it. But then that menace, right, in certain moments when he's feeling himself, so that when he becomes this cowardly, scared person who's sending everybody else to fight his battles for him, well, who does that remind you of? I thought this was a great commentary on people like this. I think Nolan is making a commentary on all those YouTubers who criticize him or people in power who send other people to do their dirty work while they try to convey that they're strong. I think he's absolutely using Pattinson's character as a stand-in and a commentary for that kind of stuff that we see in our world today and have seen in our world for decades. And so I love that that is what he ends up playing. And then, of course, he has the line of the movie, which everyone has now quoted and used. You know, somebody get these beggars out of here, you know. And so there's a great – and I saw a couple of black critics say that he may have subtly said it in a certain way that invokes the N-word because it's so close to the N-word to underscore his villainy even more and to underscore the racism that people have from a certain contingent of the YouTube space or the social media critical space. I'm not saying that was there. I just saw a couple of critics say that, and I was like, wow, I hadn't even seen it that way. So it's a fascinating portrayal by Pattinson on so many levels.
Well, I mean, it, whether or not it was intended that way or whether or not, you know, the reality is there is a class distinction that Pattinson's character sees.
Yes.
That is the same thing that we do, whether we do it by race or we do it by religion, or we do it all sorts of ways,
or
which
gender.
Is those
yeah.
people are beneath me.
Yeah.
Get them out
right.
of here, whoever they
right.
are. Right. The other thing I think is there's a difference between the desire to be the leader or the king or the hero and what it actually takes to be one of those people.
Yep.
Is that Antonius, Pattinson's character, he wants to be king of Ithaca. That's what he is
yeah.
trying to be. He's like, why can't I see myself as king? Why can't I be king of Ithaca? But when shit goes down, he stands in the background, you know, and he
yes.
can scheme a little bit behind people's backs.
Of course.
And,
yeah, yeah.
and honestly, Telemachus, while he does step up when he needs to and does fight, he is not Odysseus. Odysseus
no.
is a great man. Not necessarily that he's a good man, and often he's not a good man, but he is unquestionably a great man. When you are trapped in the cave with the fucking Cyclops, you need Odysseus. Telemachus wouldn't have gotten you out of there. Certainly Antonius wouldn't got. I don't think Agamemnon would have gotten you out of there. Is that even though, and this is something that, you know, sometimes we do, is that you go, it's worth it to have this great man, even though they are flawed. And all of us are flawed. All
yeah.
humans are flawed. If you look back at even, you know, it's like, it's tough for me. Even Abe Lincoln, we could find a couple of flaws with, although it's
sure.
tough because that
sure.
guy, but like in general, it's not, we can't have perfect people. There's not the idea
yeah.
that we have to have some perfection test in order for someone to be able to serve is silly. There are things
yeah.
where we go, okay, that's too much, you know,
right.
but there are, but like, and in fact, people that are great people are often, their greatness is as complicated, you know, their greatness
oh, yeah.
is equally complicated, you know?
Yeah. And their family life is not
yeah.
as great as their professional life. You see that all, which very much applies to Odysseus, right? Because Telemachus
yeah.
didn't even have a memory of his father. Couldn't pick his father out. It wasn't until the dog situation that he realized it was his dad, you know? So,
yeah. yeah. And we got, you know, you brought him up way at the beginning, but we got to go back to John Leguizamo's performance
yeah.
as Eumaeus. I think it is, I knew that he's in the movie and I had met that character. And then
yeah.
only like at the second or third meeting to him, I went, oh shit, that's Leguizamo? I didn't know
yeah.
he had this gear. I had no idea he could mm-hmm. do that particular performance. And it is 100% should get nominated for Best Supporting Actor. No questions asked for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, for me, as a Latino actor, Leguizamo was one of the first people you would see growing up, right? I mean, he was in so many different things. Him and Tony Plana, those are the two you always
yeah.
noticed in playing all different kinds of Latinos from different places. And so him, but he's always delivered. Like, even in something terrible like that Spawn movie, he's great as Twitch, the villain in that
yeah.
movie. I think Twitch is the name of the... And he's great in the John Wick. He's great in all these other things. When he gets a chance to shine, Leguizamo can shine. Yeah, he took the money for the Super Mario Brothers movie, whatever with that. But like
yeah.
there are other things that he, when he's had a chance to really play, like Benny Blanco in Carlito's Way, he's as memorable as
great.
Pacino is in that movie, right? Because of what he does. Because he's a damn good actor. And he knows it. He's done these one-man shows that make so much money
yeah.
and all this kind of stuff. So I take your point when you say, I never knew he had this gear. And the reason is because people haven't given him a chance to show that he has this gear. And he stands in for so many Latino actors through the years who have never had a chance to show that gear because people don't write roles for them to show those kinds of gears, those content. And there's not a lot of films where Latino actors can show that kind of stuff, you know? And so for him to get a chance to show it here in a film like this, and he's spoken about this over and over again, how much he appreciates Nolan. Like he said, I couldn't believe Nolan wanted me for this role. Like, what did he see in anything that I'd done that would make him think I could play this role this way? And he was like, it just is an honor that someone this great saw how good I was and immediately wanted me to play this role. So I think there's something really even more validating for me about Nolan as if he isn't already a great director in my estimation. The fact that he saw what Leguizamo can bring as a Latino, as an actor, period, irrelevant of race, or ethnicity rather, he saw how good Leguizamo was, but giving him this opportunity, giving a Latino actor this opportunity to show what he can do in a role like this, I think was incredible. And Leguizamo knocked it out of the park because he is a damn good actor and shows you what happens when you give good actors, regardless of ethnicity or race, a chance to interpret a character. They will bring incredible power to it. And so I thought he was so moving and fantastic in the scene at the end with the dog. And just so good, man. And so he's already been booked on the new Daniels film. So he's reuniting with Damon. And I hope this opens again, like with Samantha Morton, this opens a whole new renaissance of him getting roles in these much more serious films or much more complex films to show what he can do. You know,
this is why I'm so frustrated with the very externalized approach, particularly in the public sphere to casting, is that this character is supposed to look like this or from this ethnicity or from this race or whatever. And therefore the character that you cast must be like that. And it's like, John Leguizamo is not Greek, you know? But that's not what casting is. Casting is not like, we are not just the cover of books. We actually are whole pieces of art written within our souls. And that's what a director is looking for. They're looking for some jewel of something inside of you that can bring this character to life. And to just stop at the surface of the skin is a ridiculous thing to do to a director. Now I do. And in particular, there is place. What I should say is that for 100 years of Hollywood, they have intentionally not cast ethnic actors and cast white people in those parts. And that is a real problem. That is a different thing. And there's been pushback on that, and there absolutely should. But the idea that everybody should just, all casting is just based on how you look, what race you are, and that's it. I got a real problem with it.
Especially when it comes to classical texts like this.
Yeah.
Right? As you said, these are myths. So you can play within the myths just like you can with Shakespeare. I've seen a black woman play Henry V. I've seen, Denai Guerrero play Richard III. This is a historically real character.
Yeah.
But I love it because they bring a different element to the text. It's fascinating to see. Yeah.
Well, because when you're revisiting texts that have been revisited many times, if they just did it the same every time, what would be the point of doing that?
Exactly.
It's like, what is this new? And I think that brings us to, John, I'm not even going to say these are final thoughts because if the Cinephiles keeps going, eventually we're going to be talking about this film again one way or another, I'm sure.
Right.
But what are your thoughts at this moment for The Odyssey?
I'm just grateful that it exists and that it came out and it was as good as we were hoping it was going to be. And I love that it has ignited a format discussion, the excitement of IMAX 70mm, the excitement of IMAX, the excitement of 35 versus, 70mm, like all this kind of stuff. I like that it's opened the door for cinephiles to have fun conversations about it and see the movie in many different ways to really appreciate why those formats are so important and cherished by those of us who are cinephiles. But I think at the end of the day, it's just a fantastic film that explores so much about what it means to be a leader, what it means to rule, what it means to confront the things within yourself, what journeys you have to go on, why you have to at times walk away from the things that you thought you needed to do because of what society has told you you should be or how you should act or what you should do or what you should carry out and do. Like all those things are explored and investigated throughout the movie. And I think his modernization approach to this made it much more accessible to people like me, who are not necessarily transfixed by Greek mythology, but respect it, just have never felt the connection to it. And I felt the connection by the end of the movie and getting so many phenomenal performances from everybody up and down the board. I think Ludwig Göransson's score is stellar. Hoyt van Hoytema's, as you mentioned, his cinematography here is absolutely stunning. And Christopher Nolan challenging himself yet again. I'm going to shoot this film entirely on IMAX. Holy shit. Like just the gutsiness of a filmmaker like this to bring to life a 3,000-year-old text in a way that makes it accessible again. It speaks volumes that we are, as a populace, we do respect art. We do care about interpretations. We do go see and will patronize the arts. So for all the people who try to shit on the arts and say it's irrelevant, say it doesn't matter, this movie is a huge example of why art does matter and why people intrinsically and instinctively care about art and will go and patronize art like this over and over and over again, because they get something out of it. They're moved by it. And I think it shuts up all these people who shit on the arts and think it's not important in our society. So there's a lot of things that this film did for me that I personally loved. But at the end of the day, it's just a damn good movie that is a fun, fun movie to watch that leaves you with a lot of things to think about when you walk out of the theater.
So those final thoughts were so good that I was so enthralled in listening that I entirely forgot about what that I would have to now give final thoughts. And I'm not sure that I have them. Here's what I'll say is, like, I've only seen it once. I'm going to see it again because I think this is a movie that you have to reckon with. I think this is a challenging film. I think it's a film that is, yes, there are certain things we can be very clear that it's saying about the law of Zeus and how you treat the stranger. Yeah. And it's certainly things that it's exploring, the guilt of coming back from war, the choices one has to make, sacrifices one has to make, betrayals one has to make, and reckoning with those. That's all there. But these characters, particularly Penelope and Odysseus and Telemachus, are ones where I have to reckon with them. I have to think about them. And my guess is, as we've said about many great films, is I will feel different about this film 10 years from now than I feel today. Mm. Because it's not going to be the same. It's going to be a different experience every time I watch it. So that's what we think of The Odyssey. And of course, we'd love to hear what you think. And if you're enjoying our Cinephiles One Takes, these briefer conversations about film, we're certainly enjoying doing them. And if you want to comment on it, you can reach us on our Facebook page. Just do a search for The Cinephiles. It's Cine_files. That's files with an F, of course, on Twitter. Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. And you can subscribe to the show at all the usual places. And of course, support. We couldn't make the show without our supporters at patreon.com/thecinephiles, as well as on Apple Podcasts if you're an Apple person. And if you feel like leaving a review or a comment at your local podcasting app, that'd be great too. And if you want to reach me, I'm at SR Morris on Twitter. John, how would people reach you?
You can always reach me at The Roca Says on all my social media. And please, my YouTube channel, youtube.com/JohnRocaSays. Would love for you all to come over there and check out all the content we got going over there. And subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. And of course, our YouTube channel, the Cinephiles YouTube channel, that you can subscribe to there on YouTube as well. Thank you, everybody. Again, I express my apologies that we couldn't get to part four because of my COVID. But, you know, this was a fun conversation, Steve. And I look forward to getting back into the world of Nolan again with part four of Oppenheimer next week.
Yeah. So stay tuned and we will continue our season of Christopher Nolan next week on The Cinephiles.